Here we go.
Hello and welcome to the Valor Podcast. I gotta say, this is our first episode underneath the bomb door of a airplane that was used in military operations. We're here at the National Nuclear Museum in Albuquerque, New Mexico for this show. The museum has an outdoor display of aircraft and rockets that were used part of the nuclear mission. Inside the museum is exhibits taking visitors through the early days of the atomic age and to the current peaceful use of nuclear technology. Today, I'm joined by artist Sean Hampton. His specialty is aviation art and has been brought on to paint and retouch some of the static displays at the museum. He proudly served in our military and at a young age took to his creativity to draw and sketch aircraft. Thanks for serving our country and joining us on the Valor Podcast, Sean.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, you have quite an impressive artistic bio, and I'm just impressed of, like, I think as far as creativity, paper airplanes is about as far as I can get. And but you started at a young age. What kind of got you into that passion?
Well, I grew up. My dad was in the Air Force. I grew up an Air Force brat, and he was a helicopter mechanic, and he would take me into work several times as a kid. And I just remember just being fascinated walking around all these military aircraft at a very young age, and that really sparked the passion for aviation in my life.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about where we are right now? I mean, you gave me a little bit of history off air, but I mean, let's hear it. Let's hear the cliff notes.
Okay, yeah. So this is we're here at the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History, and currently sitting under a NB-52B Stratofortress. It's the only plane to drop a live nuke outside of wartime. So really, the only third American plane to drop a live nuke. You had the Enola Gay and Boxcar, which dropped them in World War II. And then this B-52, 1952 model, serial number 13, did all the testing. So in 1956, dropped the hydrogen bomb, and then in 1962, finished up the last testing with Operation Dominic.
That's quite a history. I mean, I was living outside of Fairchild Air Force Base, and the B-52 was constantly in the flight path. I never really was amazed about the power of that aircraft, and I mean, just to describe it, you could probably say it's a big, heavy aircraft that can do a lot.
Yes, yeah, it's a huge airplane that you know, the later models are still in use in service today, and really one of the main forces for the nuclear capabilities and nuclear command. This plane never served; it was always a test bird. So it was delivered from the Boeing factory straight to Kirtland Air Force Base and spent its whole life here in Albuquerque. Of course, it would fly to the Pacific, flew out of Hawaii for the nuclear testing, but it always returned back here and was always part of the test mission.
And talk a little bit about what goes into restoration of an aircraft. I mean, I dabble a little bit in the model, the plastic model 132nd, and you know, that gets frustrating because you drop a piece of, you know, the engine part on the ground, and there you are with the flashlight. I mean, now take it to the real life size.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, I built the same model airplanes as a kid, and you know, I've experienced those frustrations, so I can definitely say it's a lot easier on a one-to-one scale. Things like painting the landing gear, detailing boxes and stuff, you know, it's a lot easier when it's bigger. But here, the primary mission of the museum is preservation, not necessarily restoration. In restoration, a lot of things go back to return something to flight. This plane will never fly again. So our main focus is to preserve the exhibit as we have it for future generations. So that goes through, and we had the whole exterior sanded down, researching the markings, repainting everything, and trying to bring back really a historical artifact that'll be saved for generations to come.
Some people come from the idea, well, let's just scrap it, let it go to the junkyard, we'll pull parts off of it. But why is it important for all generations to have a static display? I mean, we're in the yard now, and there's all kinds of different tools that were used for the defense of our country.
Well, I think it's great to have something tangible that you can walk up to and look at that was part of history. If you only read about it in books, it doesn't have quite the same effect. You're not using all the senses. These planes you can walk up and touch. You can see them with your eyes. You can start to see kind of the gravity of the situation especially here with the nuclear side of it. When you look at the bombs from the first fat man and little boy, up to the progression of each mark of bomb, and seeing like, oh wow, we were in a race with the Russians, and behind us over here we have the Mark 17 bomb, which is the largest, it's a 40,000 pound nuclear bomb, largest bomb we built. And then then they started getting smaller as you get into more tactical situations, but to be able to see that, to be able to walk around that, this stuff doesn't exist anymore. We don't produce those bombs anymore. We don't produce these rockets anymore. So to be able to come up and see that, now, or especially, two, three generations down the road, to realize like, wow, this is a point in history. Not that we ever want to go back and repeat that, or ever be in an arms race or have to worry about nuclear war. But to be able to see that history and kind of grasp that, I think is important.
Yeah, and so the why don't you talk a little bit about your refurbishing and doing the paint touch-ups in this. What was one thing that you kind of like went home and that day and were like, wow, I did that?
Yeah, so I remember this plane. My dad retired out of Kirtland Air Force Base. The museum used to be located on the base. So I remember coming up to this plane as a kid. This plane has always been a huge part of my childhood. So be able to come back and work on it is really an honor. And I remember my primary part in the refurbishment was the markings, doing the historical research and making sure they're accurate. And so part of that, there's two insignias painted on the nose. And when we were looking at them at the original design, they were hand painted, and so we wanted to recreate that historical aspect. Normally, I'd create a mask and we would spray it, and so it would look better. But we saw that they're hand painted, and so on one of the patches, the Air Force Special Weapons Center. Now, granted, this plane retired in 1971 and has been sitting outside in the New Mexico sun since 1971.
A lot of hot summers.
Yeah, a lot of hot summers. And the sun tends to bleach certain colors and bleach paint. So we have this patch on the side of this, painted on the side of this airplane, that we know has a red background. We have the actual patch. We know it's supposed to be red. But on the airplane, it's white. And we have hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs going back to the 70s, and it's all white. And so, we had a dilemma. Okay, what do we do? Do we restore it the way that the aircraft was, or do we, paint it red to where it would have been accurate? But we wanted to keep it accurate to the actual plane. We're not trying to change history per se. If something was painted wrong, it's going to be painted wrong on this plane. So through hours and hours and hours of research, I finally found a photo, an old grainy photo online, that you can see that it was red, that it was really highly faded. And so with that, we were able to go back, and this is after the patch has already been painted. So you have to go back and do extra work, but we were able to paint the red and get the patch correct. And so that's one of those moments that made me feel good inside of, okay, yeah, I've done my job. I've done my diligence. We are preserving history accurately.
That has to take a lot of teamwork to really come to a final decision. It's like, this is what we found. This is what we're going with. How does a team like that work to restore? I mean, everybody has a certain mission to restore, but at the end of the day, your final product is the completed plane.
Right. So we there's a museum curator that we work closely with. There's a paint contractor, Efren Candelari with No Limit Paint. He's the one, the main contractor that did a lot of the spraying and did all the preparation work. So we work really as a team, as an integrated part. There's Jerry Hanks. He's the museum restoration coordinator. So he's kind of bringing everybody together and all the parts. We work closely with the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio, with their archives and going through records. And just really, it is a team effort to make sure everything's accurate.
What is one thing that you guys worked on that was like, I mean, you mentioned the logo, but other things were like, I don't know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that.
Well, this plane was pretty simple. I don't think there was a whole lot of questioning. I mean, this plane flew with multiple paint schemes during its life. So each testing operation had different paint schemes. We chose to go with the paint scheme as it retired. This was the same paint scheme that this last Air Force paint job that it received. But there were things like we questioned the outboard external fuel tanks had white or were all white at one point. So it was a question, well, do we paint them white? Do we paint them silver? The way we received it, the pictures we have from the day it retired and moved to the museum, they were silver. So we decided to go with that.
What can a museum do? I mean, sometimes that you know the base wherever they're located across the country will say, "Hey, we're decommissioning it. Here's a plane." Many people don't have the funding or know what to do. How can a museum go through that process of making it look show ready?
well, it's there's tons of volunteer hours that go into the restoration projects here at the museum. If you come any given day through the week, they're open 7 days a week. You're likely to find somebody out here volunteering their time to touch up paint. All the aircraft displays out here, they're wiring, so all the lights are going to work on all the planes, which is a really cool aspect, I think, for a museum. So if you come out, it's a lot of volunteer hours. For the main paint job, for this, they did a crowdfunding project, and so they, you know, put it online. And here's the history of the plane. You know, we're a nonprofit museum, and the paint job that paid for this was crowdfunded.
I can remember seeing that campaign, and you're like, you know, go, we're almost there. I don't have any money, but I could share it on Facebook and social media and get the word out about it. What is probably the biggest expense in restoring a plane? I mean, if just thinking about somebody that might be listening, that's like, hey, we got a plane down at, you know, the museum that needs to be touched up.
Well, if you're going to itemize it, I would say probably labor. If you're going to pay someone to come in and do the work, that gets expensive. The paint.
I heard the paint's pretty expensive.
The paint's expensive. Yeah, it's. And we're getting a deal. We're getting it close to cost, and I think it's still around $462 a gallon.
Wow, so that's an expensive home improvement project right there.
Yeah, and so this B-52, I think we're just under 60 gallons right now of paint that we put on it.
So it's a early mid morning. I can't do the math, but that's quite an undertaking.
It's a lot of money, and but you look into the labor before of having to strip or sand down all the old paint to fix spots where there's a lot of corrosion from pigeons, you know, coming in the holes, and their poop is actually pretty corrosive to aluminum, and so there's holes like in the bottom of the engine covers that had to be fixed. There's wiring that has to be put in all those little holes so that pigeons don't go back in there after we fix it. So there's a lot of labor. I'd say labor is probably the most intensive thing, and then probably paint after that.
And you kind of fell in love with aviation at a young age. Then you went to college to pursue that passion, and then 9/11 hit. What happened after 9/11?
Well, 9/11 happened September 11th, 2001. It was my freshman year in college. I was going to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And I knew I wanted to serve. My whole family has served. My dad did 24 years in the Air Force. My grandpa served in the Navy in World War II. My great uncle was a fighter pilot in Vietnam in the Air Force. And so I knew I wanted to serve. And really, I think out of high school, I just wasn't ready for college. I was doing it because that was the thing to do. So when 9/11 hit, you know, it really hit home that, you know, maybe I should just get out and enlist. So I got out and enlisted in the Air Force and did 10 years serving that, working as a mechanic, followed my father's footsteps, was a helicopter mechanic. And I was actually stationed here back at Kirtland and worked on the H-60s at the training squadron and And then with the Guard, I trained. I was an F-16 crew chief. And, you know, I loved it. I was every day working on planes, and it was a really great experience. And was able to serve my country and, you know, deploy around the world and see lots of cool stuff.
Seems like your creative side and then your professional side go hand in hand because of detail-oriented. I know a lot of crew chiefs and in the mechanics, I mean, you got to pay. I mean, it has to be perfect, or that plane or helicopter is not airworthy.
Yeah, and that's the big thing of realizing that, hey, the work I'm doing now, someone's life depends on this. Like, there's a pilot that's going to fly in this. And when you have that mindset of everything I do could end up as a life-death situation for somebody else, and that person's trusting me to do that work, it really is a huge honor. And I think most of the mechanics out there have that respect of, okay, I'm working hand in hand with this other person, and I'm the work I do is important, and so it needs to be right.
How does that go with your artistic? I mean, you know, if something's off, it's not accurate, somebody's gonna call you out on it.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in the aviation community, I think because everybody is so detail oriented, if you don't have something right in your artwork, people will let you know. And so it's always important to do your due diligence and do your research and, okay, is this right? Is this right? And so I have a group of both military friends and also artistic friends that are, you know, professional artists that have been doing it for years that I'll submit my work to. And, hey, guys, can you review this? Can you look at this? What would you change? You know, do you see anything? And through that process, through the constructive criticism, I've been able to develop my skills as an artist and really progress.
And going back to your military career, you deployed while our country was at war with Iraq and Afghanistan. You were at an air base in Balad.
Yes.
And, I mean, that had to be pretty intense in your work in terms of mechanical work, going out, doing missions, coming back. And, I mean, I think your time frame was at the height of the insurgency and the war and things like that. What did you do to sort of decompress in that situation? Did you use art as a way to kind of get out of the craziness of war, if you will?
I did. So I did three tours in Iraq, all three to Balad Air Base. The first tour was in 2004, so the war had been going on about a year. We were the first fighter unit. At the time, I was with the 150th Fighter Wing, New Mexico Air National Guard.
The tacos, right?
The tacos, yeah.
Taco Tuesday today.
Taco Tuesday. And so we were the first fighter unit to be stationed at the base, at Balad Air Base, in the summer of 2004. And, you know, I had a passion of, you know, I've grown up around aviation and I have all these books, and it's wartime, so there needs to be nose art. And unfortunately, the Air Force official position at the time was absolutely no nose art. So I probably the little bit of rebel in me decided to paint nose art. So,
creative genius, I think, is appropriate.
And so at night, I would whenever the plane wasn't flying, I would sneak into the back corner, and I had my dad mail me out a little set of Testor's model paint with the, you know, the eight basic colors and a little paintbrush, you know, just the one that comes with it, not a real great system set up. But I painted nose art on three of the jets, and you know, the pilots loved it, the crew loved it. The active duty base officials there at Balad didn't like it.
They were the fun haters.
Yes. And so that was kind of like a mini project in 2004. And then the third time I went back was with the tacos again in 2008. And so I decided, you know, all the pilots are like, yeah, we need to have nose art on all our jets again. So same thing, you know, secrecy of night, going out there with a paintbrush, and this time I had a little, it wasn't spur of the moment, so I kind of knew what I wanted to do.
Did you have like a headlamp on? How did you, was this like Rambo with paint?
Yeah, I'd have a friend with a flashlight or a headlamp, and so we go on, but I talked to each crew chief, and hey, what do you want on your plane? I'm gonna paint something on there. What do you want? And so the second time around, the art was a little bit cleaner, a little bit more, you know, laid out. The first time was just kind of, oh, what can I paint, you know, and it was a lot of random stuff. But so the second time Yeah, designs were a lot cleaner, and that actually garnered the attention because there hasn't been a whole lot of nose art. You start seeing it with some of the tanker units, some of the bomber units, but with fighters, there wasn't, up until that point, there wasn't a whole lot of nose art. And so pictures started circulating, and really around the world, people were interested in this nose art that was on these New Mexico jets. So I had a guy contact me from a model airplane decal company and said, "Hey, we would love to reproduce this." And I said, "Sure, absolutely." And he was asking if I could do it. And well, at the time, I didn't know how to do anything with graphic art or digitally. But they got me a copy of a program, CorelDRAW, and I sat down one weekend and I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna push every button on here and just see what it does." And you know, it was a process, probably 4 or 5 months, but I was able to draw and recreate all this artwork. And that led into a lot of work for these drawing model airplane decals, and kind of birthed into the kind of graphic art aspect that I have now.
That's incredible. I could just picture dry 120 degrees with your headlamp, and you're doing those with those little 8-ounce little things.
Yeah.
So going back to the tail art or the nose art and all that, you know, I'm kind of a World War II guy, like the greatest generation, if you will. And you see some of the planes that were flying, they had pinups, they had other types of things. Talk a little bit about how important that was, kind of for the morale aspect of it, and also that sort of pride that, you know, that's our plane. We're dropping, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially nowadays, well, I guess it was the same back then. You had... you know, a camouflage plane is pretty plain, pretty drab, pretty basic. And so you have a piece of artwork on there. Well, it makes that plane stand out. And it's definitely something you can take pride in as a crew chief. Like, wow, that's my plane. That's my artwork. Or the pilot. So you wouldn't come out and like, "Oh, I get to fly in this plane." Or "I get to drop a bomb in the plane that has this artwork." And, you know, they range from personal. We did a cleaned up pinup, if you will, politically correct pinup, for one guy. He's a real big World War II fan, all the way up to a memorial piece for the New Mexico men and women that had died.
Nice.
And so pilots, there's a range of them. So pilots would take honor and like, "Oh, I get to fly in this today. I get to, you know, showcase this."
Yeah, some of them, you know, were not for kids' eyes or you know, ladies' eyes. I mean, they were pretty risque back then.
Yeah, some of the old ones there.
And so what, you know, kind of you were saying that some of the higher-ups, you know, don't approve of it, or, you know, there's a policy of it. Do you think that there needs to be, you know, if it's the plane and it's appropriate, that they can sort of have creative leeway? I know the military is very structured and things, but sometimes those things can boost morale.
Yeah, actually, about a year ago, the Air Force changed their policy. And so now they do allow nose art, but it has to go through several...
Has to go through committees. Yeah.
Right. So you would submit it to, you know, your squadron commander, who would go to wing commander, then go up to... And so it basically goes all the way up to the top, and then they, okay, this isn't going to offend anybody. This isn't... this is appropriate. We can put that on there. So there is a policy in place now to allow nose art again, but it is a lot of paperwork to get there.
Me hanging out with veterans, I you know, I find different aspects of things that people are in. Some are into music, some are into art like yourself, some of them are into restoring cars. There's that creative side to the veteran. You know, they're when it's time to go, it's business. You know, we're there to save lives and defend our country. But when you're doing your creative side, is there a way to foster that with a veteran? How can... you know, somebody like myself, like a civilian, or even groups around that, you know, help these guys that are deployed out, you know, maybe they like guitar or maybe they like to paint. How can people get involved?
Well, there's a lot of resources out there. I think people just have to look. That would be my first thing. Research, look into whatever you're passionate about. Go look into stuff. For me, with the veteran, in fact, what I'm taking advantage of now is, now that I'm out, I'm doing the GI Bill. And so I'm in school, and I'm able to take classes to learn to better craft my skill. But I'm also looking at like community centers. There's a lot of free classes that are offered, community colleges that, you know, that aren't that expensive. That hey, if you want to take an art class, go take an art class. If you want to go take a welding class, you know, go take a welding class. Find groups of people, and social media has been amazing at that, of really making it easy for groups of people to come together with like interests.
And that has been really beneficial for you in terms of the business side. I've seen some stuff. That's how I got connected with you. I've seen some of the stuff you've done, and I'm like, wow, this is really good. How has that helped your business?
Well, it's been a process. Like I said, I started with kind of the graphic when I was drawing for the model airplane decal stuff. I turned that in. You know, the Air Force has what they call lithos, but their side aircraft profile unit prints. And I was pretty much doing the same thing with the decals. And so my thought was, well, why don't I continue with this? And so that was the start of my business. Was starting to produce aircraft prints for different units. And through word of mouth, you know, the word gets around different units around the Air Force.
Hey, maybe there's one that you just painted.
Yeah. There's no. And, you know, it really developed like, you know, I'm fascinated by art. And so with aviation art, I've moved more away from the digital into fine art. And so I started oil painting. You know, I've never oil painted before in my life, but I found a group of people that had, and you know, it's the process of I found if you just ask, people are almost always willing to open up and share with you. And so, like I said, now I have a group of artist friends that I'd submit stuff to, or hey, how do you do this? And with me, a lot of it is trial and error. You know, I'm not afraid to try new things, and so I'll pick up a brush and sometimes it's by mistake, and I see how an effect comes out, and I'm like, oh, wow, that came out really cool. You know, I didn't mean to do that. But yeah, that'd be my advice. Don't be afraid to try new things and branch out. Don't be afraid to ask questions. And people are out there. People are willing to help.
You're like the new Bob Ross.
Yeah.
I mean, he was Air Force and started his own thing. So
I'm not quite at that level, but maybe someday.
Someday. I see talent. But you know, sometimes, you know, that there's a lot of people that say, oh, you're really good, Sean, you know, but, you know, we want you to do this, and can you do it for free? It'll be great exposure and all that. You know, I run a company, and I get approached all the time to do free stuff, and, you know, at the end of the day, I end up telling them, well, my kids can't eat exposure. It, you know, it just doesn't, you know, I got to put actual food on the table, roof over the head. How can a artist, and specifically maybe a veteran artist, kind of gauge what to charge and how to, you know, get paid for what they're worth? I mean, I know sometimes the budgets are tight and they can get like $20, but it's $20.
Right. And you know, I think that's probably the thing I've struggled with the most is where do you place your value? And someone once told me that your worth is what someone's willing to pay for it. And so in order to, you know, the term starving artist, you do a lot of things for cheap. Everybody wants it for free. You know, there's not a whole lot of appreciation for the arts or for fine art. So I'm undercharging myself, and I find that. And finally, it comes along with, you know, one of my customers was buying a piece, and he said, no, I'm going to pay you this. And so I was like, okay, that made me sit back. This is what it's worth. And so I was able to come back around and kind of redo my pricing structure. Okay, what did he pay, you know, price per square inch, or and really it's looking at other artists, other comparable artists. What are they charging? What is the quality of their work versus the quality of mine? So there's a lot of things that go into it, but you know, I'm doing a degree in business, and so with economics, you know, the market will find the right price.
What is one thing that in the military that kind of prepared you for business that you took away and you're like, that's, I'll hang my hat on that, or, you know?
Definitely the structure and time management. It is so important to have discipline and manage your time wisely to steward what's been given to you.
Yeah. Well, Sean, you know, it's been a pleasure to kick back and talk under a bomber bay here at the museum. And, you know, I'm really honored to have you here, and I'm looking forward to see your path. I mean, I've seen your work and everything like that. And so I can't wait to see what the future holds for you. You can check out Sean's work at facebook.com/SeanHamptonAviationArt. Is that?
Yes.
Yep. And so you can see some of the behind the scenes of him painting the aircraft. You can see some of his lithograph work and get involved with his future work. And so I want to thank you for listening to the Valor Podcast. Make sure to like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play or any podcast management app. Visit us on our webpage at thevalorpodcast.com. Again, find your mission. There are many veteran organizations, nonprofits, and veterans that are needing your help. Maybe some advice or even a word of wisdom can help them with their new career or new path in life. Thanks again, and have a great day.